Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Sitara Thabani. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Anne Anlin Cheng, professor of English and African American Literature at Princeton University and author of the brand new book, Ornamentalism. Dr. Cheng, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, before we begin, let me just say congratulations on your book. It's a very stimulating read and also a really important intervention, I think, not only in Asian American studies, but in critical race and feminist studies as well.
Thank you. It's a project that means a lot to me. So I'm grateful for that comment.
It was a pleasure to read. Can you tell us, how do you explain ornamentalism as a concept and as a framework to your readers and to our listeners today?
Well, I usually start by just talking about the word because it's in many ways, such a strange word. It's a word I did not make it up. It's been around since the 19th century, usually used by art historians to describe the condition of ornamentation, and in particular, being overly ornamented. But it's a word that I cannot hear it without also hearing its almost near homonymic echo of Orientalism as a term. But I seem to be the only one who have noticed that. And thinking through that, I realize it's not just a idiosyncratic thing on my part, but rather that actually, in fact, there has been a long philosophic and aesthetic discourse that from Plato to this day, to the 21st century, that associates and actually, in fact, conflates the so-called Oriental or Oriental character with over-ornamentation. And so what this book tries to do is, one, bring out that deep philosophic connection between the ornamental and the Oriental, so that the word, to me, at the very first level, represents the fusion of the ornament and the Oriental. So that's what the word, the first thing it does is names that connection, that very long philosophic connection. And then what I hope to do with it, what I hope I have done with it, is to offer the word not just as, you know, a new word to describe an old symptom, but rather as naming, in particular, the processes through which personhood gets named or created or legitimized through ornamental prosthetic gestures. The word really for me aims to name that transformation, that magic that turns a thing into a person. So this book, Ornamentalism, is on the first hand, is about the connection between the Oriental and the Ornamental. But more importantly, I want it to be a conceptual lens through which we can think about how the ways in which things have been turned into persons.
Mm-hmm. I think you make that case very clearly in the book with the broad range of examples that you provide, ranging from legal history to cinematic production, fashion, and art, and also, as you're saying, over a very long period of time. Can you take us through this process of how you selected these examples and how some of these connections became obvious to you?
So I would say that the examples or the case studies did not grow out of the thesis around ornamentalism, but vice versa. Rather, ornamentalism is a concept that I came to after having looked at these cases. So I didn't pick them. They, in many ways, they came to me. They're things that have been of great deal of interest to me over time. But what I realized also over time is that they are connected in that they are all meditations around this question of artificial personhood and how it is embroiled with ideas of Asiatic femininity. And I also realized in sort of putting together in once I realized that connection, I also realized what I wanted very much to do is for the book to be one chronological so that we could track the development of ornamentalism from the 19th century to the present day. And I also wanted very much to have case studies from different fields, you know, as you say, law, popular culture, art, cinema, etc. Because I think this idea of the artificial person can manifest itself in all these different realms. And it is in seeing how this figure animates these different realms that we see how, in fact, expansive and extensive the notion of Asiatic femininity is, even though for most of the mainstream culture and world, it seemed like such a marginal topic, you know? And so I'm hoping through precisely the range of the example to show the impact of this marginal figure on, in fact, very non-marginal stages.
Mm-hmm. And so this idea of tracking these examples over time, can you speak a little bit about the continuities as well as any divergences that you found in how Asiatic femininity is being not only represented, not only objectified, but constructed through this kind of ornamentalism?
Yes, I think we could see through, I said 19th through the 21st century, is that on the one hand, part of the point is that things don't change, right? That she continues, that this figure continued to be represented as exotic, alien, thing-like, synthetic, artificial. But what I think we do see over time is that how this figure, that in spite of all the, I would say, disciplinary actions put on this figure, in spite of the objectification, or rather precisely because of the objectification, this condition of being an object, instead of being, I think, like, you know, as feminists and as race scholars, we often shy away from objectification because it is a deeply dehumanizing process, right? But I think what shying away from that has done is actually prevented us from looking at what are the kinds of lives are actually formed as a consequence of this objectification. And so what I think is interesting about the examples is that they show they're not recuperative moments in which I'm not making an argument for the ways in which Asiatic women, for example, have fought against this objectification they have, but what I'm interested is in how these conditions of objectification, instead of calling these moments objectification and therefore thinking that we have a good handle on it, what we might want to do is see how these moments yield surprising, unexpected other forms of survival, other forms of ontological animation. So I think what I try to track through these different examples are, on the one hand, how extremely disciplinary ornamentalism can be. On the other hand, also allow to come into view alternative modes of being, alternative modes of survival for those who may not have that much agency. So I think what I try to show is the changing face of ornamentalism itself. And all the, I don't try to negate the negative consequences of ornamentalism at all, but rather I try to also acknowledge the potential of thinking about different kinds of being in the, different ways of being in the world, given the confines of ornamentalism.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing to build off of this idea of these different ways of being and these different tensions that emerge, one tension that's really striking throughout these various examples is that between the body and ornament. And this tension comes up repeatedly in your book. Can you expand on the relationship between the two, that is the body and the non-organic ornament, and describe the impact that this has on the construction of race?
Right. I think it's a tension, not a mutually exclusive relationship, but definitely a tense one. And I think what I want to do is think about the implication between body and ornament. So I'm interested in their interface, right, rather than their mutual exclusivity. But I think one of the major points of this book, and that one of the driving questions for me, is that I think the body, or the idea of the body as a corporeal, organic entity, has haunted and preoccupied race and feminist scholars for a very long time, for very obvious reasons, because the racialized and gender body has often been in jeopardy, and it is therefore not surprising that it is a source of much attention and often just recuperation, right? But I think one of the things I've been trying to think through is that I've noticed that, well, first of all, that there is a tremendously rich, wide, and deep body of theoretical work in feminist thinking around the Black female body. And it is a repository of theoretical work that has really, I think, enriched how we think about the Black female body, whether it is, most notably, of course, Hortense Spillers talking about the hieroglyphs of the flesh. But what I realized at the same time, and I have learned so much from this body of work and engaged with it continuously, but what I also realized is that our attention to talking about the body has actually turned our gaze away from a different history of racial embodiment, one that may not be as rhetorically or even philosophically or imaginatively indebted to the flesh as it has been indebted to non-organic things. And in particular, I'm thinking about Asiatic femininity and how instead of being a creation, a conceptualization that is rooted in the flesh, it is actually very much rooted in artificial, oftentimes almost exclusively ornamental things. And so what I try to do in this project is to say, let's look at how bodies are formed, maybe not based on language of the flesh, but on language of synthetic thinliness. And what is revealed when we think about racial embodiment in this alternative way? So I'm hoping what I'm offering is a different logic of racial embodiment, one that doesn't displace, but rather complements and engage with an existing body of thinking around racial embodiment as enfleshment.
Mm-hmm. I think that segues very well into the next question I'd like to ask. And that is, you begin and end your book in conversation with Black feminism. And I wanted to ask why you felt that was important, both as your starting and finish point.
Well, the starting point is because I think in many ways, and for very many people, and certainly including myself, Black feminism and Black studies have been the models on which other subjects of color have started to think politically, theoretically, socially, culturally, and so forth. So even just speaking as an individual, I know that my thinking around race and gender have been deeply indebted to, inspired by, and rooted in African-American studies and Black feminism. So I thought it was very important. But at the same time, as I said, I think that the richness of Black feminism and Black studies have actually also kind of not being able to address some of the more peculiar specificities around other subjects of color, the yellow woman, for example. So I started there, but I wanted very much to also point out another strand of critical thinking, race thinking, another strand of feminism that should be also engaged with in meaning conversation. And then near the end, I returned to Black feminism through a discussion of Toni Morrison's Beloved, because I actually really think that ornamentalism, even if it started out as my interest in locating a kind of specificity around the yellow woman, nonetheless can lend itself to having conversation with other women of color, because I think that this alternative logic of a racial embodiment that I'm speaking of, a racial embodiment that speaks from the abstract, that speaks through the synthetic and the ornamental, that is not exclusive to Asiatic femininity, but also I think can complement. So that's why thinking about Black feminism, and that's why I come back to Toni Morrison's Beloved, because you know it's one of the most noted texts for its celebration of Black female bodies. There's that lovely homage to the body by one of the characters in Beloved, but very few people have observed that Beloved is also a book that very much turns to the aesthetic, the abstract, and ornamental things precisely in moments of profound racial and corporeal crisis. And so I thought this is a good opportunity to demonstrate the ways in which ornamentalism can also be productive for Black feminist thinking.
So can we turn now to talk about the multiple subjectivities that we can see being formed through ornamentalism, where you do focus the book on the figure of the Asian woman. You also indicate that ornamentalism plays a role in constructing the modern subject, that is this idea of Western personhood, as well as we're seeing in Toni Morrison plays a role in shaping the construction of Black womanhood as well. And so can you please expand on this role that ornamentalism plays in constructing multiple forms of subjectivity?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, generally our idea of modern personhood this day is it's an idea that is based on a whole host of writers, mostly male, from the Enlightenment, right? Our idea of the modern person of personhood is indebted to notions of an organic, integrated, usually mostly masculine individual, right? An individual full of agency and will and self-determination, a Cartesian subject. But what I think that history leaves out is a different genealogy of modern personhood, one that is not indebted to the ideals of the organic, but the inorganic, one that is not integrated, but more fragmented and aggregated. And this different genealogy is that this, which I think the yellow woman exemplifies, but is not the only example of, is actually integral to how the West has formed its notions of personhood. So I want to bring to the foreground a different ideal personhood that has been brewing in the heart of Western modernity since its beginning, alongside the integrated, you know, enlightened subject. And it is this idea of personhood as something that is legally and philosophically constructed out of abstract notions and abstract thingliness that is, of which Asiatic woman is but one example, I think a very acute example. But this history, this alternative history, is in fact what allows today we think of, you know, legal conceptions of personhood. So, for example, our idea of a corporate personhood, you know, so many people and scholars who work, legal scholars in particular, who work around the corporate personhood, has written extensively about this. Like, how is it that we have that in the law we treat a corporation like a person? how is it that we treat this incredibly abstract notion thing as of a corporation as having the rights and the abilities and the will of a person? And those scholars will tell you that that's not a new 20th first century thing. That is rooted in the fact that legal personhood has always been constructed around relatively abstract notions. And this is why there's such a language, I think, of ornamentation in the law. We talk of, rights that are attached to you, things that ornament you, the legal ornamentations that construct, that makes a person, be entitled to certain kind of rights. So part of what I am trying to suggest is that the yellow womanhood or yellow person and the synthetic yellow person is but a particularly acute instantiation of a long history of Western personhood being indebted, in fact, not to this organic integrated person, but to other much less organized, less organic forms of being. And so part of my argument is that the yellow woman is not simply important to Western personhood by being its other, by being its opposite, by being excluded, but actually she expresses a particular notion of personhood that can be animated through things that is in fact wholly in keeping with the Western construction of personhood from legal realms to cultural realms.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I kept hearing Mitt Romney in my head when I was reading your text about corporations.
Tell me how so. Well, you have to tell me how so.
Well, this idea about corporations are people, and this sliding or jumping between what is and is not inanimate object, what is or is not a person, and this term object life that you keep introducing into the conversation around this figure is really fascinating.
It is kind of an amazing, I think, the whole idea of corporate personhood is just an amazing example of the ways in which legal personhood is constructed and mediated through a host of issues that has nothing to do with the biological, or the organic.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, it's the same of race, right? I think most people, when they think about race, they think about it in biological, corporeal terms. But racial differentiation, racial embodiment is as much constructed out of abstract notions as it is out of, biology. I mean, I think that the pretense is that it's about biology, but it, frankly, I think it's almost never about biology.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think you show that very well in bringing together these various seemingly contradictory but not really aspects that come together in racial formation. And another one of those tense relationships, perhaps, that you reveal is that between aesthetics and violence. Could you expand on that relation?
Yes, I think if you think about the history of Western art, from Titian's Rape of Lucrezia to Picasso's Guernica, you will realize that if there's one tension that Western art has been struggling with for centuries, it is this tension between this. It is precisely the meeting, not the tension, but the meeting between aesthetics and violence. And it's an ethical question. What does it mean to aestheticize violence? And conversely, what does it mean to see the violence of aesthetics? And this is a very large, question. And I think this is a question that is particularly acute and has particularly material consequences for the Asiatic woman, whose form of denigration in the West is peculiar, right? It's different than, let's say, Black femininity, in that Asiatic femininity has so long been aestheticized. And what's been very hard for a lot of people, I think, general public to comprehend is well, what's so bad about being aestheticized? And of course, feminists have been, you know, explaining for a long time what's wrong with that. But I think having a feminist theory that can account for this particular form of denigration, its consequences, as well as its, you know, byproduct, is really critical. You know, so when Hortense Spillers tells us that Black female flesh is ungendered because he has been excluded from the realm of gender, we might think about Asiatic femininity as having a different kind of relationship to the gender system, right? Like in some ways, she is hyper gender, right? Because she is like the ultimate, ideal version of femininity by being passive, you know, erotic, etc. But that is a form of being included in the gender system that is extremely excluding, right? So I think that this question of the aesthetics and violence is a very large ongoing question for Western art and culture. But what I try to do in my book is to distill it around the figure of the Asiatic woman as a particularly powerful example of how we might think through the meaning of aesthetics and violence.
Mm-hmm. I think on the question of aesthetics, but then building off of that as well, another thing that's really striking about the examples that you study in the book is the relationship to temporality and how they either appear to be fairly antiquated ideas about Asian femininity. And I'm thinking of the pictures of kind of the traditional dress or even the quote unquote ancient objects that get or ornaments that are used as examples here, or this extreme kind of futurity and looking to the cyborgs and kind of the post-human idea as well. And so could you speak a little bit about those two different temporal directions in which this figure is being drawn?
Well, thank you for that question, because that's actually one of the meanings. So you know, mini question got me started on this project. And one of them, as I said earlier, was how come no one's ever noticed the Oriental aspect of ornamentalism? So that's a further. But the other question I had was, I started to notice, I wonder why is it that the Asiatic woman can be not alternately, but simultaneously so regressive? I'm having a mind blip. the geisha, you know, figure, for example, and or seeing oftentimes, certainly, you know, in science fiction and in the world that people now call techno-orientalism, she's so often the sign of the cyborg, and in fact, a perfect example of how this two temporality is collapsed into one is in that recent remake, Hollywood remake. Live action remake of Japanese anime called Ghost in the Shell with Scarlett Johansson. And in that movie, they have these geisha who turn out to be robots. You know, the mask get removed, they're robots. And it's a perfect, I think, instantiation, a perfect example or manifestation or reenactment of this paradox of, you know, the Asian woman as both atavistic and futuristic. And so this is actually, and I think one of the answer to why is this the case has to do with ornamentalism, with the fact that the Asiatic woman was always seen as somewhat machine-like from the get-go, even when she was being seen as atavistic. And my example was that is from the 19th century, a very famous show that was on exhibit in New York and other major U.S. cities was a show, an exhibit simply known as The Chinese Lady. And this was a young woman, very young, around 16 or 15, who was imported by basically what turned out to be circus people to the U.S. And she was sort of touted around as a, she sat in a sort of living tableau And she had, you know, very, as you said, very traditional Chinese dress on. And she's surrounded by, you know, Chinese ornaments, teapots, paintings, scrolls, things like that. But so everyone saw this as just, you know, that, you know, obviously a kind of, you know, a perfect example of the old school, you know, the sort of classic civilization, the ancient, almost decadent civilization of China. That's what she represented. But I also trying to point out that that tableau is very mechanistic. It is very constructed. All the elements in the tableau are often, like, for example, the china on display, they were actually not, you know, real Chinese antiques. They were sort of Victorian, you know, tea set duplications. And so even in that very so-called, you know, old image is all this sort of global, very modern global exchange of things and thingliness. So, yeah, I think that, you know, one answer to how come she's both is because she's always been both.
Mm-hmm. Well, after reading your book, I find it remarkable that people haven't been talking about the connection between the two, because you just make it so convincing and reveal it to be such a strong connection between Orientalism and ornamentalism.
Thank you. I hope at least can invite others to have conversation about this.
Absolutely. And so finally, to close, can you share with us what you might be working on now or what's next?
So I have been working on a second project that looks at the intersection of race studies, animal studies, and critical food studies. So my little bridge to that is that I'm currently working on a paper. I can't think of the next big project. It's too scary. So I think of my next paper. So the next paper, is about the idea of swarming. And it's actually a very good bridge, because ornamentalism is about the profusion of ornaments, of details. And this idea of profusive details is a kind of swarming, which then leads me to thinking about the animal and so forth. So I'm writing now a piece about starting with, and again, you can see I'm moving over the place, but I'm starting with William Morris and how he conceptualized design in his work, his theories of design, and how his theories of design have, as you can imagine, or not surprisingly, very national and gendered and racial parameters. And I want to connect that to more contemporary artists. One is a poet, Sally Wen Mao, who wrote her first book of poems called A Mad Honey Symposium, which I think is about a kind of swarming. I think the more William Morris' wallpapers are swarmings. And finally, I want to think about the installation work of a contemporary artist called Anika Yi, who has been working with these amazing installations that one of which is called Immigrant Caucus, that from far away, it looks like a motherboard, like a black and white technological, beautiful architectural, abstract, electronic piece, you know, motherboard. And you get up close to it, and it turns out it is a giant ant farm.
Okay.
So anyway, these are all just interesting, provocative examples through which I want to sort of think and theorize the idea of swarming as a provision of detail, animation of abstract things, but also its relationship to race subjects, immigrants, who are obviously always discussed as a kind of swarming. Mm-hmm. So that's my next project and what I'm moving towards.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to it coming out.
Thank you.
And thank you again for taking the time to speak with us today about your new book, Ornamentalism. I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Thank you so much for spending the time and letting me talk about this book.
Of course.